Abortion should be allowed when a mother's life is at risk. This is something that we as pro-lifers hear quite frequently. It is an episode that we have covered long, long time ago here on the podcast, and so we are going to do a rehash of it today. Stay tuned. Hi, folks. Welcome back to the Pro-Life Guys podcast, a show dedicated to equipping you with the tools that you need to have compassionate and compelling conversations about abortion so that together we can change minds, save lives, and transform our culture. My name is Cam. I am the host of the show, and it is good to say those words again. It has been far too long since my last episode and since I've had the opportunity to sit down and do a little bit of recording. It is a busy, wonderful time at CCBR right now. We are running our internships, which are currently four-month paid programs where young men and women from across the country and indeed around the world come to Calgary or Toronto to come and gain invaluable training and experience changing hearts and minds on abortion, saving lives, transforming our culture. Altogether, we have a wonderful team here in Calgary, where I am based. I'm sure that the team in Ontario is just as lovely, though I haven't met any of them. They run such a good ship out there. Anyways, I'm sure that there's going to be some really, really cool updates that come through this summer as well. I am excited to interview as many of them as I can wrangle into my office to do Humans of the Pro-Life Movement episodes. There's a few of those in the backlogs as well. And I am running my return internship, which is for people that have already done at least one internship before, taking on personal projects. We've got Maria, who is doing a bunch of graphic design for us. We've got Carmel, who's going to be taking over some volunteer coordination components in Vancouver. We've got Carolyn. Carolyn's wonderful. She is going to be doing some mentorship and support of our new interns because she has a tremendous amount to offer to them in support and in kind of coordination together with the team leaders. And then we've got Jess, who is actually one of my first at-distance return interns. I don't think that I will meet her in person this entire summer. I met her down in Florida. She was a wonderful girl. She's doing a ton of one-on-one workshops for us virtually, maybe a few in person, but almost all of them are going to be virtual. And so if you would like to sit down with somebody and get our formal training for how to have good conversations about abortion, I'm sure that you pick up nuggets here and there in the podcast. But if you want to have an immersive experience, contact us. I'll put the email in the show notes, but it's email@prolifeguys.com. Which is very cool. She'll be probably giving dozens, if not over 100 individual workshops over the summer, which is going to be a huge help for us out here. And there's just an awful lot on the go, which is really, really, really cool. We have 7 people signed up for the Narnia book club that we'll be launching. I'll be leading those discussions, I believe, on Saturday. So there'll be an email that goes out to everyone. So thank you for signing up so far. If you haven't signed up already, we're going to have maybe another week or so before registration closes. If we get close to 10, that'd be really cool. But that's a bunch of announcements to get off my chest. Here we are, 3 minutes into the show already. You haven't heard any of the content. When a mother's life is in danger, this is such an important conversation for us to be having, and not in a waffling kind of mentality, but rather speaking with boldness and clarity together with our compassion is absolutely vital. I will actually mention that. Sorry, I just about got the train going. Went to the Alberta March for Life as well and spoke there both during the March for Life as well as the apologetics afterwards. I would love to do a recap video at some point about the Alberta March for Life. It was really cool. Got to meet a bunch of people. It was a little bit weird because of the 10 speakers. We had 10 speakers in Alberta, which was more than I think we've ever had before. I was the only not religious leader there. I don't think that I'm a religious leader. I don't think anyone would characterize me as a religious leader in any capacity. I hope not, at least. But everybody else was a priest or a pastor, or there was a Muslim imam. There was a Sikh leader as well. I was the only one not coming at this from a religious leadership perspective. That was a little bit strange, but kind of cool to make some cool connections there. And so I would love to get your impressions if you were in attendance to any of the Marches for Life that happened across Canada, whether the one in Alberta, the one in Ottawa, the one in Toronto, or any of the other ones as well. But let's get back up on this horse and let's talk about when a mother's life is in danger. This is something that comes up fairly frequently in conversation. I think abortion should be allowed when a mother's life is in danger. And it's important that we tackle this with compassion and clarity, because it feels for a lot of people like this is a gray area. It feels as though there are some people who would like to claim the name and the identity of being pro-life, but don't know how they can do it in light of a mother's life in danger, and they don't know how to articulate it. There are some people who use this as a human shield, trying to defend all abortions, and they're simply looking at this strategically as the easiest pro-abortion defense. And therefore, they're going to try to huddle all of their other abortion justifications behind it, because they know that this can trip up a number of pro-lifers, or people that fall somewhere in the middle, that they just don't know where they stand on this. They don't know enough about prenatal development. They don't know enough about the medical situation in Canada to be able to speak with any degree of clarity. And most tragically, there are the people who have been told by their own doctors, or who have a loved one who has been told by a medical professional that they need to have access to abortion if they're going to survive. And so I want to get a little bit of the background out in front of us, so we've got that bouncing around in our minds with clarity before diving into the pragmatic response that we are going to offer in these cases. And so the first thing that I think is absolutely vital, that I hope that we're all on the same page for, but tragically, many of the people that we're going to talk to may not be on the same page. Abortion must be very clearly defined. What do we mean by abortion? The first thing that we do not mean by abortion is the simple practical process of removing the body of a child. And I think of this because a good friend of mine, while I was working at the cafeteria at the University of Victoria, I worked a lot of jobs. And so for those of you that have been along for the ride for a long time, you've probably heard a lot about a number of the different jobs that I worked. But I worked at the cafeteria at the University of Victoria while I was doing my undergrad there. And I was quite good friends with one of the other girls that was working there. She was an older woman. She was kind of a career coordinator at this point. And we used to spend a lot of time chatting just while we were washing dishes or serving customers or whatever it may be. And that all kind of came to an end when she found out that I was going to be leaving over the summer. She wasn't expecting me to keep working at the cafe during the summer because I would need full-time employment, and that was not an option. But when I told her that I was doing a pro-life internship, she just stopped talking to me entirely, particularly when I told her that I would be doing a pro-life internship in Calgary. And she started avoiding me, and we could not have any kind of a conversation whatsoever, especially not a non-work-related conversation. But even work-related conversations were incredibly strained, until I finally asked her, what's going on? I know that I told you about my pro-life opportunity coming up. Like, I get that not everyone is in that position, but I hope that you can appreciate how I want to be a part of rewriting the narrative about pro-life people and how much we care and all that kind of thing. And finally, she opened up to me and she said, in the mid-1990s, she didn't tell me the exact year, but in the 1990s, she was actually living in Calgary, and she had been told by her doctor that her child was stillborn, that her child had died while in her womb, and that she would need to go to the abortion facility to have the child removed. And so she was not supportive of abortion at that time. She didn't want to have an abortion, but the doctor told her, okay, your child has already died. We're not killing a child in this case. I don't know if the doctor is pro-life at all, but I will take them at their word, and at the word of the girl that I was talking to. She said, you know what, this child is stillborn, and so you need to go to the abortion facility because they have all of the tools and procedures necessary. And so you don't go to one of the hospitals because they're very backlogged, blah, blah, blah. Go to the abortion facility and have your child removed. And first of all, that is a tragic, tragic thing to do, to compel somebody to go to a facility known for killing preborn children, to have a procedure done that is not going to kill a preborn child. There's so many raw emotions going on in anyone's mind at that point that that seems barbaric in my mind, to send somebody into the Kensington abortion facility or whatever it was called at the time, without that clarity, without fully understanding the fact that she wasn't having an abortion. So not only was she going through all of that, not only was she going through the trauma of a stillborn child, but when she arrived at the Kensington abortion facility in the mid-1990s, there was a group of pro-lifers that were there. And she told me that they were shouting at her, calling her a murderer, saying that she would be murdering her child, to the point that they began to throw rocks at her to try to deter her from going into the Kensington abortion facility here in Calgary. And that obviously shaped the way that not only she understood the abortion issue, but also how she understood pro-lifers. And she just told me, Cam, I don't think that I can handle you becoming another one of those people, that you seem like a good guy. And if you get too involved with those pro-lifers, you're going to turn out just like them. And you're not going to be the kind of person that we need in our world, not the kind of person that I would want to be a friend with. And so there's that clarification. I mean, we shouldn't be throwing rocks and calling people murderers as they walk into abortion facilities, even if they're having abortions, because that's probably not going to be the most conducive way to get them to come out and have a conversation with us and draw them towards hope and healing. However, the first thing that we need to clarify is that abortion is not simply the mechanical procedure of a dilation evacuation or DNC or a full removal sort of thing, that the mechanical procedure must kill that preborn child. A child, a miscarried child, tragic, is not the same as an abortion in any way. And so first I'll make that clarification. Second, I'll make the clarification that abortion is also not something, just anything that could result in the death of a child. That for our intents and purposes, abortion for our conversations is the direct and intentional killing of a preborn child. And so I often clarify that by explaining that imagine a mother who is pregnant early on in her pregnancy is diagnosed with late term cancer, whatever form of cancer it may be. It's an aggressive form of cancer that the doctors agree must be acted upon with all urgency. If she's able to delay her treatment until that child is viable and can be delivered, then praise God, let's do that. If the child cannot be delivered in a living state at that point, then I would argue that using the principle of double effect, that mother should be allowed to pursue chemotherapy and radiation. Thankfully, cancer treatment has advanced to the point where there's certainly not a guarantee that in going ahead with cancer treatment that child is going to die. However, tragically, there is at the very least an increased risk that child may die should that mother receive chemotherapy and radiation. And in that case, I would argue that it is morally appropriate and allowable for that mother to receive those treatments, even though that might result in the harm or even the death of her child, because the intention is not there, because the direct action is not there, that intervention is successful based on whether or not the mother survives the cancer, right? The livelihood or tragic death of that child has no bearing on whether or not the procedure is successful, whereas an abortion, for our intents and purposes, is only successful if the child dies, that a failed abortion is one in which the child survives. And so that's the clarification I often make. Sometimes I will go further and explain for ectopic pregnancy, for example, there's traditionally three different forms of intervention. And I'm not going to say the names of the individual interventions because I don't think that that's necessarily worth your headspace and trying to memorize them. Because even if you can memorize these, you're not going to be able to memorize every single form of medical intervention, whether it be hypertension, whether it's preeclampsia, whether it's anything else. And so rather than posturing as though we're medical professionals, I would say that there are arguably three methods of intervention for ectopic pregnancies. When a child implants in the fallopian tube, we can either poison them using a drug called methotrexate. We can physically attack them by scraping them out using curettes and other utensils, or we can surgically remove that portion of the fallopian tube in which that child is preserved in a living state. And tragically, we don't have the medical technology to prolong the life of that child. But if we look at each of the three of those forms of medical intervention, if you look at the poisoning one, the methotrexate, that is only successful if the child dies. I don't think that anyone would characterize it as successful, though it might, I suppose, in theory, happen that you could detach them from the lining of the fallopian tube and somehow collect the body of that child in a living state. I think many medical practitioners would agree that that procedure is successful when that child has died. Similarly, that procedure of scraping them out and physically attacking them in that way is successful once that child has died. However, the removal of the fallopian tube is successful when that portion of the fallopian tube has been removed. It has zero bearing on whether or not that child survives or not. And Lord willing, we will come to the point where we are able to sustain the life of that child through the remainder of their natural life well into adulthood. And so there's that consideration as well. That's often the clarification that I will make. And if necessary, I will clarify the fact that our intentions do matter, right? That if I am on the bank of a shore and I see two people fall out of a canoe far from the shore and both of them are struggling to survive and I swim out to try to save them, if I know that I can only save one of them and I won't be able to return in time to save the second, there's a fundamental moral difference between me rescuing the one that I can and doing all that I can to get back in time for the second, but failing in my attempt, and acknowledging that I will not be able to rescue that second person. So holding their head underwater until the bubbles stop coming up and then rescuing the other person. Sure, there is one survivor and one deceased in both situations, but I don't think that it requires a rocket surgeon to acknowledge the fact that intentions matter. That while tragically both of those people may have drowned, the second person may have drowned in both scenarios, one of them is a tragic limitation on our capacity and ability, and that could change with advances if I become a stronger swimmer or if there's another person available and all this kind of thing, that the actions that I take in saving the one do not preclude the ability to save the other, whereas in the other case where I am actively drowning the other person, that is contingent on the intentions of my activity, that I am trying to kill that other person and that it is successful only when that person has died. Intentions are not what I want. It's not that I want that person to die out of a spirit of maliciousness, but rather the mechanical intent of success and failure. So again, when a mother's life is in danger, it is not as though we're assuming that the mother wants to end the life of the child in either situation, whether it's taking methotrexate or whether it's removing the fallopian tube. However, the mechanical intent of poisoning the child is to kill the child, regardless of whether the mother maliciously wants to kill them or not. It's not our willful intent, but rather the mechanical intent of the procedure. So hopefully that brings a degree of clarity to that. And thankfully, medical practitioners around the world have agreed that it is never medically necessary to save the life of a mother to intentionally kill her child. And that is something that Canadian Physicians for Life have acknowledged. That is something that is recorded in the Dublin Declaration, which I will drop in the show notes below. The Dublin Declaration is something that it's good to have in the back of our mind. And yet, very little of this is what I would call conversation material. This is really good background information for us to be familiar with. And maybe you're in a conversation in which it becomes appropriate or prudent to share some element or multiple elements of this. However, the approach that I would want to take, rather than spiraling into an appeal to authority, if we appeal to the authority of the Dublin Declaration or to the Canadian Physicians for Life, or maybe you yourself or even a medical practitioner, if you appeal to authority, you open yourself up for a he said, she said kind of debate of, sure, your 1,000 medical professionals say that abortion is never medically necessary, but I have heard it on good authority that it is medically necessary. The American Medical Association has said that there are times in which medical intervention can only be achieved this way, or something like that. Or why did the doctor tell me or my sister or my spouse or my whomever that I needed to have an abortion? And we don't want to necessarily get bogged down in the fact that often medical professionals will suggest or even encourage or maybe even exclusively identify abortion because they don't see the issue with it. And they ask, why would I bother suggesting a more expensive, a more difficult, a more complicated, a more costly, a more procedure of intervention when I can recommend abortion, one of the quote unquote safest procedures, at least for the mother, one of the cheapest procedures, one of the most accessible procedures? Why would I offer something far more convoluted than that if this, in my mind at least, is a morally appropriate solution? And so that goes very far into that conversation about how and when do we have that conversation. And so that's a whole bunch of background information. What am I actually going to say in conversation? The first thing that I want to do is I want to clarify why they are bringing up life of the mother. And so when I ask, hey, what do you think about abortion? Oh, I think abortion should be allowed in the case of life of the mother. Okay, is that the only circumstance that you think that it should be permissible? Do you think that it should be allowed in other cases as well? And I'm going to do this for a different reason than some. For some people, they're anticipating a response of, well, no, I think that it should be allowed in XYZ other cases, in which case the pro-life will then say, okay, well, let's not deal with life of the mother right now. Let's deal with it later, and I will tackle one of the quote-unquote easier or more elementary cases. I don't want to do that. I am asking for clarification to know whether or not this is the only case or one of many cases, because I want to know if I am offering clarification or if I should be treating this in a steel man kind of thing, that if I can change their mind on abortion in cases of life of the mother, then it's probably all downhill from there. And so if they say to me, well, no, I think abortion should also be allowed in cases of sexual assault and when a mother's really poor, and you know what, I think that a mother should always be allowed to have an abortion, I'm not going to put life of the mother on the shelf. I am going to tackle it just as I would elsewise. However, I want to know that, to know where this person is coming from. Because if they say, well, no, I think this is the only circumstance, I just don't know how I could justify telling a mother that she can't save her own life, I want to go into the route that I'm going to talk about in my next episode of affirmation. First of all, you know what, I really commend you for thinking through this and not supporting abortion in these other scenarios. Let's talk about this one. And so either way, I'm going to tackle mother's life is in danger. And I'm going to start with the common ground that we're very used to. I agree with you that that would be one of the most overwhelming and horrifying cases to ever be found in. To be told by a medical practitioner that your life is in danger is going to be simply overwhelming for anybody, regardless of where you're at on the abortion conversation. And so we all agree on that. Of all of the cases, so literally every single other justification, whether it's a hard circumstance, whether it's bodily autonomy, whatever it may be, we are always going to go through the common ground analogy question. This is literally the only example in which we add something. So after we build the common ground, we offer that clarification. I agree with you that XYZ, this is an incredibly difficult situation for anybody to be faced with, regardless of whether they have been looking forward to this pregnancy or not. I would like to clarify that when we're talking about abortion, could we agree that an abortion is the direct and intentional killing of that child and not simply any form of medical intervention which might tragically result in the death of a child? Can we agree that there's a difference between the two of those? And if we can, then we move on. If we can't, then we offer one of those clarifications that I offered beforehand of, no, I think that abortion is anything that results in the death of a child. Okay, imagine that I were a pedestrian and I saw two people drowning is there a difference between me going out and pushing somebody's head underwater or tragically not being able to make it back in time? Is there a difference in intentions? Hopefully that will clarify it for them. And you can move from there. But if they do acknowledge, or if they come to acknowledge that there is a difference between trying to kill the baby and not trying to kill the baby and that baby tragically dying, what we're going to do after we affirm that difference is that we are going to confirm that that difference matters. And so we do agree that there is a difference between those two. Could we agree that if those two are available, if you have the option to save the mother's life without trying to kill the child, you must always choose that other option. You must always choose the path that does not try to kill that child. And we want them to agree with that, that if you've got the choice of I'm going to try to kill the baby or I'm not going to try the baby, every single time we have to try not to kill the baby. Okay. And could we agree from there, if we always have to choose the option that does not try to kill the baby, could we agree that if ever we are told that our only option is to kill the baby, it would be a moral requirement to ask for a second opinion, particularly from somebody that would likely disagree with that diagnosis? That if you've got the choice, and if the two choices are presented to you, you would have to pursue the choice that does not try to kill the baby. And if you were only presented the one choice, you would be morally obligated to ask for a second opinion. And that second opinion coming from somebody that you have confidence would offer an alternative if there was one available. I would point towards either the Christian Medical and Dental Association of Canada or the Canadian Physicians for Life. And by doing that, I have accomplished what we spoke about earlier. I have accomplished the fact that abortion is never medically necessary to save the life of the mother. And so first of all, if their doctor acknowledges that and gives them the option to pursue a different course, then they have to pursue that. Or if their doctor doesn't, then they're going to call somebody who will acknowledge the fact that abortion is never medically necessary to save the life of the mother. And so they're going to get a second opinion that will be life-affirming at the very least. And the third and final thing that I'm going to encourage is, could we agree that if somehow, if there is somehow a world in which you call the Canadian Physicians for Life or the Christian Medical and Dental Association of Canada or whomever it may be, and you were not able to find an alternative procedure, that we have to do everything within our power to bring about a change of that so that nobody is ever confronted with that crisis and dilemma again of not having an alternative course of action. And so common ground is number one. Two is the clarification that there is a difference between intentionally killing the child and not intentionally killing the child. Three is that given the choice between intentionally killing the child and not intentionally killing the child, you have to not intentionally kill the child. If you are told, number four, if you are told that there is only one intervention that is intentionally killing the child, you must seek out an alternative opinion from somebody that would be inclined, invested in providing that alternative. And fifth, if there is even at the end of that day, no alternative, then we have to do everything within our power to bring about an alternative. If I can walk through all five of those steps and have them agree with each of them, then I would argue that person is fundamentally pro-life in that case. And I would demonstrate that to them. Okay, bearing all of that in mind and bearing in mind the fact that there are doctors and other medical professionals around the world that acknowledge that abortion is never medically necessary, you can say with confidence that you are against abortion, the direct and intentional killing of an innocent human being, in every circumstance, including when a mother's life is in danger, because you have clarified that that mother may still receive medical intervention provided that intervention is not intentionally going to kill that child. Okay, hopefully that makes sense. Five steps there. I'm going to go through a very similar case with somebody who supports abortion and is using this as a human shield. But where it changes is that you will probably break down at step three. Step three being one, common ground is hopefully going to resonate with everybody. Step two, they will acknowledge that there is a difference between something that will kill the child intentionally and something that won't. However, they will disagree that we have to be mindful of that in step three, that we have to choose the course that does not kill the child because they do not recognize them to be a child. They're going to say, but no, it's different. They're not a human being. You don't have to jump through those hoops. You don't have to pursue a procedure or an intervention, which might be more convoluted, more expensive, blah, 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 whatever it may be, because they're not human. At which point you are going to pivot towards the human rights argument. Could we agree that all humans should get human rights? Yes. If something is growing, even from one cell to two cells to four cells, isn't it alive? If we have a living organism from fertilization that has human parents, isn't he or she a living human? And wouldn't that make abortion a human rights violation? Well, technically they're human, but they're not a person, they're not sentient, whatever. You're going to go into your human plus X. Why aren't they sentient? Is it because of how old they are? Why is killing somebody because of their age any different or any better than killing somebody based on any other factor? And so you are going to go through the same approach. I would not recommend the approach of let's not talk about this right now, let's talk about something easier, not only because it guarantees that you're going to have to come back to it later. If you can walk them through poverty or even sexual assault, you're still going to have to come back and deal with life of the mother eventually. And you're also going to be planting the seeds of this person is avoiding this. This is the elephant in the room. Maybe they don't have a strong answer, that kind of thing. I would like to tackle their strongest argument as early as humanly possible in an effort to be as efficient as humanly possible. And so hopefully that makes sense. Let me know if you have any questions one last time. Number one is find common ground. Number one, find common ground. Number two is offer the clarification that the mechanical intentions of the procedure matter. Number three, that given that difference between intentions, you must always seek out the option that does not intentionally kill that child. Number four, that if you are not given an option that does not intentionally kill that child, you're required to seek out an alternative opinion, a second opinion from somebody that would be inclined towards protecting the life of that child, if at all possible. And number five, if at that end of that day, the pro-life entities that have acknowledged that abortion is never medically necessary, if somehow they fail to find an appropriate medical alternative, then we do everything within our power to produce a moral alternative. If we can get them through all five steps, I am confident that with that understanding from whether it be the Dublin Declaration from the Canadian Physicians for Life or other pro-life medical authorities, that abortion is never medically necessary, that we will be able to help that person appreciate and understand the fact that abortion is never morally appropriate, even in cases of when a mother's life is in danger. Again, if they're using this as a human shield, I'm not going to blame them for it. I would attack somebody that I disagree with the strongest argument that I either believe myself or one that I know that they're going to struggle with the most. And so I don't think that this is inappropriate in any way. And I would try to tackle that, pivot them towards the humanity of the preborn, go through age-based discrimination and go from there. Thanks so much for tuning in. There'll be a few notes in the show notes below that you can check out. As I mentioned, if you want to join the Narnia Book Club, you're welcome to do so. Sign up in the show notes below as well. We're going to accept maybe two or three more people, and so get in quickly. And I hope that you are doing great and that you are prepping for a great summer of engagement and outreach. May God bless you abundantly wherever you're at, however many hours are left in your day.